Test. Wonderful, the technology works today. Right, welcome to the lecture number 5. Today we had a quite interesting insight into how info stealers work. Marko Kristić from Serbian CERT gave us the presentation and just had a chat before the lecture that I was surprised that, you know, the Steam accounts can be a considerable assets as well, that, you know, it's even such stealers, they have own functionality to target these Steam accounts and all other types of data that we have on our computers. So today it will be an introduction in the legal systems, legal context. Also it will be description of Budapest Convention, so Cybercrime Convention. How many of you heard about Cybercrime Convention from before? Perfect. So it's one of these, let's say, documents, famous documents that everybody referred to, but there are a lot of considerations. So you always are welcome to check this convention yourself. It's not a very big document, but you can just get the PDF file and check it. All right, so it's the lecture 5 today, and next week lecture 6. And then you can see there is a gap, so there will be a lab week. So we're going to post more information about the lab week. Many of you asked me what are the dates for the lab week. The most up-to-date information is on the NTNU website. If you go to IMT 4114, you will see a timetable, time schedule. So please check the rooms and also the time slots. So 3 days we'll be there. So today it was the info stealer. And then next week we'll have AI and malware analysis. So I also asked Marko to give me the slides, just in case if anyone wants to go through the slides and, you know, read the references and maybe ask something and send emails to Marko. Yes, the paper presentation, so I still need to submit the paper presentations. It's very important, so it's not graded, but it's mandatory, and you need to pass this type of hand-in submission. So cybercrime law in the course book is one of the chapter, and it was written by a legal expert, a lawyer. So we'll cover briefly, you know, the legal part of the, let's say, of the system when it comes to technology, the difference between, for example, European and American legal systems, and also cybercrime conventions. So we won't go very much into details because it's, let's say, the law aspects are a little bit on the side and out, perhaps at some point out of the scope, but still you need to be aware of what is cybercrime convention, how it's applied, let's say, what are the section chapters in there, how it regulates the cybercrime and, you know, the response to cybercrime, what kind of technologies. When it comes to technologies, please remember that the Cybercrime Convention is old, so it's been ratified many years ago, like 20 years ago. So it means that, you know, some of the modern technologies like drones and, you know, other things, they're not included. So the Cybercrime Convention, it covers, let's say, fundamentals of the computer systems, but when it comes to novel technologies, it's not there because the technologies did not exist at that time. So the The overview of the lecture is the legal context for digital forensics, legal systems and type of law, uses of law, digital forensics and law. So as I mentioned before, we have an incident response that is an enterprise area, and then we have also the digital forensics. So digital forensics, this is in relation to crime investigation and also work of the police. So on the exams, you will have questions related to, for example, you know, what is the challenges of using, for example, cloud providers, and you know, how it affects when there is an agreement, the police agreement between the countries where the cloud provider hosts data, and where, for example, we have countries that do not support any types of the agreement. So it very much depends on the application. Like cloud forensics is a super complex issue that is not that trivial, because it depends on how the data is stored, which countries, if the crime is happening in one country, the data in another country, is it possible to get a snapshot or the data itself, are there any logs available, is it possible to share the information from the police of one country to the police in another country, and so on. And of course, depends on the jurisdiction, like what kind of jurisdiction exists. Formal law, we'll talk about fundamental, fundamental legal systems, procedural law, like what is evidence, digital evidence. Different types of law. The European Cybercrime Convention or Budapest Convention also, I will mention briefly, let's say the Norwegian law, and when it comes to, you know, structure of the courts and the legal departments. So how the law pertains to investigation and digital evidence handling. As I mentioned, everything that we found on the digital carriers are digital data that are considered to be digital evidences. So some of the things are acceptable as an evidence, and some of the things have to be included at later point. So the law systems is basically a set of rules meant to govern behavioral, or let's say the social behavior. We have, you know, the basic norms that exist in the society, like, for example, shaking hands with your right hand. We have rules, procedures, guidelines, policies, like, for example, a new policy of information security. And then we have the law. We also have the human rights, the fundamental human rights. They're given to individuals regardless of, you know, whether they've been fully implemented in the particular legal system or not. So it's very important to remember that there are the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So the law of the legal systems, the European one, there is a normal, let's say, set of bills and legislation that defines the law, and also, you know, the system, for example, can refine it. There are no precedents that can define or change the law, so it's not, let's say, in our legal systems. The U.S. legal system is different, so probably you've heard from the from different cases, from movies, that like they've been established a precedent, like party one versus party two. So that's a common kind of phrasing that you'll see in the U.S. legal system. And then, you know, the way how it's done, that there is a certain kind of scenario that, you know, if we have a precedent, then the next hearing and the next decision, the court ruling will be based on this precedent. So they will kind of refer to the to these precedents. And doctrine of stare decisis, so it means that stand by the things decided. So if there are, you know, there was a decision, then they need to stand by this decision to do the decisions in future. Scandinavian courts are more flexible. So the normal legislation that refines existing law, technically applicable the same ways in Norway. So there are two sets or two bodies of law in general when it comes to legal system, when it comes to, let's say, systems in general. So there is a criminal procedure and civil procedure. So you can see from the name that criminal, you know, there are different procedures, like, you know, arrest, preliminary hearing, charges, trial. So it can be crimes against single person, offenses such as robbery, murder, and physical punishment. The civil, so this is more like a civil case, you know, something like a conflict or something. So it's usually filing a complaint, pre-trial, trial, represents the dispute between two individuals. There are private rights, contracts, like, for example, divorce and so on. So multiple cases where it's not a criminal case, but more like a dispute between two individuals on some certain case. So in nearly all countries, we have these two fundamental types of law, the criminal and the civil. So the criminal law is created by governments through legislation. So the whole idea is to punish the, let's say, antisocial behavior in the society, and punishment of the undesirable behavior through different set of laws, like, for example, drug abuse. So the crimes, it's the, let's say, the offense against the public body, so like the crime against, for example, a society, against the country in general. So for serious offenses, the victim doesn't have to complain, because in such cases, like, for example, a murder, it will be prosecuted by the state, because this is a kind of a criminal act against the society. In that case, the prosecutor represents the state, and the state bears all the cost of the prosecution and affiliated cost with the trial. And defendant might be provided with the state-supplied advocate. So it's kind of the case where the state is involved, and the state, so to speak, organizes the whole process. So the crimes against the property, like vandalism, stealing, the crimes against persons, stealing, assaults, murder, and so on. And the crimes against the state. So currency counterfeiting, elections, espionage, sabotage, treason, or saying things that one don't like, in some countries that can be considered as a crime as well, right? So it depends on the level of democracy and legislation in a particular country. But this is something that is against the state, you know, like, for example, state security, and so on. So it very much depends on the, you know, on the considerations and involved aspects. Crimes against the state also involve, for example, the drug offenses. So sometimes alcohol, considered to be illegal in some of the countries. Violating religious rules of conduct, because in many of the countries there are certain strict rules how the behavior should be, and everybody must comply. So it's very much depends on the country and depends on the jurisdiction. So civil law. The civil law regulates disputes between two parties, like people, groups, corporations, like wrongs in U.S. interpretation. So the court settles the dispute. So the court is kind of the final resource that decides, you know, what is the outcome, kind of. Contract law, trusts, the wrong party brings the suit directly to the court. So that's why you see these names of the rulings, like, for example, person one against person two, or the company versus person, or the person versus company. And all the parties must bear their own costs. Many legal situations involve both the crime and, let's say, the wrong part, or the civil part. So, for example, the person might be acquitted of the of the criminal murder charges, so the criminal part of the case, but downloading copyrighted material, that was something that the person was convicted. So it means that, you know, it can be either, for example, there is no wrongdoing on the civil part, but there is a crime, or vice versa. It depends on the case again. So in the US, it's sometimes possible to sue the state, like Wade. In Norway, complaints against the state are settled through ombudsman. How many of you heard about ombudsman? So sometimes there are ombudsmans, let's say on the state level, sometimes it's on the organizational level. Also in the Birka organization, you will have ombudsman. So if something is wrong is happening and the person is not happy with the organization, so there will be ombudsman. So it's kind of tightly connected with the whistleblowers at some point. So the ombudsman, it can be a children ombudsman, a gender equality anti-discrimination, armed forces ombudsman. So it's something, if the system, for example, is not working or there is a criminal behavior, then the ombudsman has powers to intervene. So criminal law is against, criminal law is about punishment, and civil law is about compensation. So we have the direct costs, like, for example, the damage costs, like if there was an accident because somebody, was under the influence of the alcohol and drove in the other car. So there will be hospital bills, you know, lost wages, and also indirect costs, loss of companionship, pain and suffering. So something that is it cannot be estimated, like, you know, from the bills, but it's estimated according to other considerations. And there will be also punitive damages. So it's not for the compensation, but for punishing this behavior. So in overall, the civil law, or when it comes to civil law, it's something that is between the individuals or organizations. It's nothing criminal, but for example, there can be some kind of dispute between neighbors. There can be some kind of dispute between the employer and employee in either ways. So it can be resolved, you know, through civil kind of procedure. So of course the people can go directly to court and represent, like, why for example one person thinks that this is a wrongdoing, right? So it's not a crime, because in case of crime, if the crimes are defined, it's clear, like, if this particular behavior, like a murder, is a clear crime, so the state will be involved. In the case of civil hearings, it's not. It depends on how you present the fact, which are in your case, for example, neighbors. You know, if one neighbor came to other neighbor property or land and cut a tree, right? So that can be a civil case. But it's not a criminal behavior, so it's not that the state will be involved. In that case, there will be involvement, between the parties first, so they can try to solve it. Because, you know, one person may think that, well, this is my land, you know, like, why did you come to cut the tree? Obviously, you had no rights, you know, so you can claim the compensation. Another person have some other imaginary options why it happened. So if they cannot agree, they can go, for example, either directly to the court. But in this case, you know, all the expenses, they have to be carried out by people involved. So if the victim in this case complains to the court of law and makes a case, then, you know, if the person who complains loses the let's say the whole case, then he or she needs to pay all the expenses, like, for example, lawyers, administrative expenses, and so on. But if the other person who did the damage loses the case, then usually it's the person who is paying the affiliated, expenses. So I'm not talking about direct or indirect expenses when it comes to, for example, suffering or something, or, you know, the tree that was damaged, but also the administrative part of the case. Of course, it can be solved earlier. So, like, for example, conflicts road. So it's, the body that helps to mitigate, kind of, and, you know, to mediate in such procedures. So it's very much different between the difference between criminal and civil law. So in the criminal case, there are strict procedure rules. So they has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt. So we already talked about it a few lectures back, but I just like to mention that, you know, there has to be a proof. Like if it's a murder, then, for example, there will be a body and so on. So there is a beyond reasonable doubt that the crime has happened. In case of civil setup, it depends on the particular evidences, right? So like if the one neighbor cut the tree of another neighbor, something like this, then each of the neighbors, they need to present enough evidences to prove that there was a wrongdoing. So it does not necessarily need to be, you know, the 99% or beyond a reasonable doubt, but it has to be argumentation within the, let's say, framework of law, like why this happened. Maybe, you know, that neighbor that cut the tree thought that this tree was planted by, I don't know, extraterrestrials, and it represents the danger, right? I'm just joking, but of course, you know, there might be reasons. So it depends on, like, what kind of, vector and what kind of evidences you bring. And then which one weighs more and, gives more certainty, then this one will be the winning one. Just to represent that particular aspect in case of digital forensics training, you will see often the training, if, for example, in your career later you will have some courses, that two teams of, students or investigators are giving a data, right? A disk, for example, a hard disk. And there is a general information about what's on the disk. Like there was a person who was using computer, there was some case or there was some incident happening. And one of the teams, they need to prove that actually that was the person who committed, for example, an attack. And another team needs to prove that, no, that wasn't the person. That was, for example, a hacker or a virus. So it's a very common kind of like a type of a game in digital forensics education where it all depends on this kind of certainty level based on the facts. So if you can establish enough facts that are trustworthy and support the hypothesis, then, you know, the team will win. So there are different systems and, let's say, levels of courts. Like, for example, district courts, 83 in Norway, the board municipal courts, tribunals, traffic court, family court, land court, labor court, national insurance courts, and so on. So it's very much depends on the application area. And also, like, if there is a ruling from one level of courts, you can always appeal to the next one. And then, you know, hopefully it will be resolved. If not, then, you know, there will be always some kind of higher authority at some point that will say that this is the final ruling, that this is the final decision. So Norway is divided in six appellate court districts, and Norway has a Supreme Court. So, like on the general level, there is a European Court of Human Rights. You know, if something is believed to be damaging to the human rights, and the person does not see rulings from within the country as the reasonable or, let's say, trustworthy sometimes, or for whatever other reason, there is always something that is a bit higher level. So the Supreme Court is the highest court in Norway. Decisions are final, they cannot be appealed. The Court of Appeal is the second instance, and there are six courts of appeal in Norway. And there are district courts, so these are the, let's say, the first instance where the case is created or submitted. Now, speaking about the... So we talked about criminal and, let's say, civil setup or type of the legal systems that we can, you know, see depending from the crimes. So it can be like serious crime, like a murder, or it can be more a civil setting. Now, criminal legal systems. There are two judicial systems in the world. Let's say the main, of course, there are more. You will find maybe a few more, but the rather minority. But we have the common law, and we have the civil law that I'm sure you probably heard about it. So the common law is mostly UK and Commonwealth countries, like USA, Canada. And the civil law is from continental Europe. So most of the countries in Europe, they're not using a common law, right? So it's just the different systems how the law is working. Like in, for example, American system or Commonwealth, we have presidents, right? So there is a precedent that something has been ruled out by a court, and then this type of decision will be later used for the next decision in a similar setup or while argumenting for such decision. So common law is not codified, civil law codified, and judicial precedents are binding in the common law. The main law source in case of civil legal system is constitutions and legislation, like, for example, we have in Norway. The judges establish facts and apply provisions of court in Norway. So also the difference is that, for example, in common law, the judges interpret the law, while in, let's say, the civil law, the judges usually applies the law. And also the interesting aspects, the common law is more adversarial and civil law is less adversarial. So you probably noticed while reading or watching movies that, you know, one person is telling to a company, to another person, I will sue you. So it's a very, let's say, broad range of things, how people can, for example, create a case by suing, for example, company or another person. And I cannot say it's popular, but it's rather common in US, for example. When a person goes to a shop, buys a product, and then the product is damaged or did some health damage, for example, and the person sues the company who sold it, and then sues the company who produced and so on. So it's kind of rather common aspect there. In Europe, it's not that common that, you know, if you go to a shop, then you buy a product that did some damage the product was bad. You don't go directly, you know, to the court of law and say that I want to sue the company. So that's the big difference. So the English tradition of the common law, it's not everything, let's say, that has been designed, written by legislature. So it's based on the previous ruling, previous decision. We'll talk about the Daubert standards. It's also part of such case when it's based on the previous decision. So in common law, courts can create new law by setting new precedent. So it means that if there is a ruling of the court, the next similar cases will be also taking into consideration this ruling, like stand by the decision and then continue applying this decision in similar cases. Legislation can revise the explicitly written laws. And usually there are jury trials in common law. So Roman jurisprudence or the civil law that is applicable in Europe, it's basically the law that is written on the books. So we have certain like legal bills that you know will be used to make the decision later. It helps narrowly interpret the law. It's usually only the highest court or the Supreme Court that can set this precedent. So it's rather exceptional, something that is normal in US, it's rather exceptional in Europe. So there are no jury. And in Norway, it's a mixture of lay and professional judges involved. Of course, there are a lot of difference between these systems, and also it's very much, defines the digital forensics aspects and the tools and what kind of digital evidences can be accepted. So, like, for example, in common law, must argue why something should be admitted as an evidence in a court of law. So what is evidence rule, how it must be collected, preserved, interpreted, and so on. So there are a lot of also standards when it comes to digital standards, certifications, trainings when it comes to digital forensics, software, digital forensics process in general. So in common law, you have to argue why something should be allowed to be admitted as a digital evidence. While civil, you need to argue why something should not be allowed to be admitted as an evidence or as a digital evidence. So that's the difference. That is usually decided case by case basis. So generally, it's less strict rules in Norway. So you can bring everything that you had related to the case, and then on the initial stage, the lawyer will decide whether it's relevant or not, and then there will be hearings in a court of law, and maybe something can be accepted or not. So it's less strict rules when it comes to accepting of digital evidences. So most published papers on digital forensics are from US, right? Because you need to argue why something should be considered as acceptable for this particular case. So there is also martial law in extreme situations, like, for example, state of emergency in the country, like state of emergency in Syria since 1963. And also state, the juntas, like, for example, in Greece. So it's also martial law. So it's just the different types of who is in charge, in the country. Now, Convention on Cybercrime, as I mentioned, this is a Budapest Convention. It's roughly 20 years old. It was a fundamental, concept and act that was put forward because there have been famous cases of hackers in the end of 80s, then 90s, like Kevin Mitnick, if you know, so all these kind of famous cases. And then at some point there was an understanding that it has to be implemented in the legal system of a country, because the ICT aspect wasn't introduced in the law part. So it's called the Budapest Convention or Cybercrime Convention, signed 23rd of November 2001 effective from 1st of July 2004. 49 nations have ratified the convention at that time when it was signed. So it means that it will be a law in the country. And then six more signed, you know, that it's more like contribution towards making the law. So they ratified and they confirmed that there will be a law. But of course it doesn't happen immediately, so it doesn't mean that, you know, like if they sign the convention, next day it works. So it took some time, but please have a look at the convention itself. So convention are interstate international agreements, what should be illegal within the states or the country that signed this agreement. But it's not law, so like it has to be kind of codified at later point in order to be able to consider it as a law. So the states promised to have their legislation kind of adjusted to enable cybercrime convention. So criminalize all the offenses, so the computer-related offenses, as I mentioned before, you know, like it can be ICT used as a tool to commit a crime, or ICT was a target, for example. So each state is responsible for enforcing their own cybercrime laws. So as I mentioned, it's not the law itself. You cannot really break it, but once it's codified in the legal system or the law, the books in the country, then there will be certain punishment for certain types of offenses. So the, for example, Convention on Human Rights is different because it has also own court in Europe. Some important countries have not signed it, like Brazil and India, on the grounds that they didn't participate in the drafting, so it's a valid reason. Russia claims that it would violate sovereignty of the country, usually refuses to cooperate with law enforcement in matters pertaining to cybercrime. So that's the common thing, you know, some of the countries will not sign due to some other consideration, and you cannot really force it, but this is more like international politics where, you know, the countries try to create a common legislation or a common act to address certain societal challenges. So there was an additional protocol to Cybercrime Convention on 1st of March 2006. 22 states ratified, 13 have to sign. Criminalizes racist and xenophobic material, so digital material, including Holocaust denial. So U.S. didn't sign it because it is not consistent with United States constitutional guarantees. So again, it depends on the country, so each country needs to consider it for their own. The same with GDPR. So it was the Data Protection Act before that, and then the GDPR that came into force May 2018. But there have been a lot of talks and a lot of, like, let's say, rounds of discussions how to implement what will come, you know, how it will change, you know, the overall operation. Because now if the company collects data, personal data, for example, or the data from the customers, there will be always a statement according to GDPR, like with data custodian, like what they're doing, what the data stored, and things like this. So the elements covered by the first three chapters in cybercrime conventions. So what kind of behavior is illegal or criminal? So like harmonization, the law between the nations. For example, if there is an abuse image or the image of a child, is it abuse or not? So like what kind of things are defined as illegal or criminal? Procedural laws for enforcement of the above. So it means that it will give police the power to investigate it as an illegal or criminal activity. And it enables the faster and more efficient cooperation between, let's say, forces on the international arena, international layers. Things like, for example, Europol, Interpol, so all of you know. It's an example of international cooperation. chapter 2, the section 1, what activities to be criminalized in the law. So offenses against CIA, not that CIA, but confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So technically, you know, there was this first attempt to introduce a computer terminology in the legal context, like what kind of things, you know, confidentiality, data protected against like reading, you know, modification and let's say stealing. Computer-aided offenses like forgery, altering important data, fraud, altering data to obtain the money. Content-related offenses, offenses related to infringement of copyright and related rights. Because also, you know, for example, in some of the countries, if you look for Justin Bieber without registration songs, you know, sometimes you just want to listen without installing Spotify. No, you just need to get this set of files. In some of the countries, it's not monitored or it's not implemented just in the legal systems. In other countries, not only the websites that distribute this content, you know, digital content, copyright, let's say, infringed content, but also the ISPs will be tightly connected on monitor who is downloading what. So violation of network security, like breaking into computers, so it's quite general, you know, now we can say that breaking into mobile phones, breaking into smart homes, and so on. Production, sale, and distribution of hacking tools. So like, for example, lockpick sets, well, it's technically, you know, a hacking tool that can be used in a criminal setting, but also it can be used in rather training setting. Right, because like in the course, if, what if you're using, you know, digital hacking tools like debugging, hex code viewers, reverse engineering, so that's kind of on the edge. I mean, if it's a training or ethical hacking, penetration testing, then there is a certain level of acceptance. Section 2, common provisions, expedited preservation of data, production orders, search and seizure of the data, real-time collection of the data. So it's very important, like if there is a suspicion that person is involved in the crime or attack, there has to be a certain level of real-time collection, or at least the possibility to collect some of the data. And section 3 is establishing national jurisdiction. The common provisions is pass laws to establish the procedure powers required, said laws in compliance with human rights instruments. So it means that, you know, it kind of is codified in the in the particular law how to approach and what kind of procedures to use. Production order, like when, you know, for example, the IP that was used for some attacks or for some crime is forwarded to ISP to identify the user, so there has to be some kind of like procedure for that as well, and how to seize and search the data. So the police cannot just, you know, come and take all the devices. They need to have some kind of, you know, procedure. So procedure law, like what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Real-time collection of the data. It's chapter 2, section 2. So can they direct the ISP to record user traffic, like wiretapping? But again, you know, the ISP might not have the capabilities to do so because, you know, it's too much data. Can gather evidence is focusing on specific individuals. So, you know, what if the ISP cannot collect all of the data? So there has to be a decision of based on the intelligence, based on the previous information, what kind of things to collect. And the computer crimes and in general attacks usually involve multiple countries. So it means that, you know, it's not just one country that is involved, but also perhaps people from other countries accessing this computer system or something like this. So chapter 3 is the international cooperation. As I mentioned, you know, organizations like Interpol, Europol. And the section one defines, you know, the general principle relating to international cooperation, extradition, mutual assistance, and also like what to do if there are no agreements at all. Are there like possibility to exchange the data? Is it limited? Is it you know, kind of bound to certain areas that the data cannot be released? So it very much depends on the context between the countries. But normally, if we talk about Europol, Interpol, there is a cooperation, like international cooperation. So you probably heard about the cases where the Europol was involved, you know, to fight the counterfeiting goods production, you know, the illegal content distribution, and so on. So it's very much related to this type of cooperation. So section 2 defines specific provisions, like, for example, mutual assistance, like data interception, collection, preservation, access to data, availability of the law enforcement participating in this agreement. And then chapter 4 is the final provisions. When it comes to such type of agreements between, you know, between the police forces, it's always, let's say, boundaries, what they cannot do, what they can, you know, exchange and how they can exchange. Often you will hear, you know, the cases between, for example, US, I don't know, New Zealand, Australia, that have been quite successfully investigated and prosecuted because they have a very strong cooperation agreements. Like, for example, have you heard about Silk Road? So Silk Road is an example where, you know, people were involved from, like, Australia, you know, they kind of get in touch with the admin of the website, and there was the main admin in the US, you know, doing these illegal activities and managing the website. So it's it highlights how such cooperation is important and how this cooperation can result in a very fruitful investigation. Of course, if you take, I don't know, countries like US and Russia, for example, if there is a request to exchange, you know, information on cybercrime, most likely there won't be any response from either of the side or from both sides. So unfortunately, in some cases, this cooperation do not exist, and even like any type of investigation cross jurisdiction won't happen. So it will be like a cold case. Chapter 3, section 1, general principles related to international cooperations, like who are the liaisons, like who is kind of supporting the work of other law enforcement agency in other country. Like, for example, if you talk about Title II, this is principles relating to extradition. Julian Assange, I mean, just have a look at the complexity of the whole case. Australian citizen accused of sexual assault in Sweden. In UK at the time of extradition request, surrendered, remained and bailed by UK police courts. Skip UK bail to take asylum in Ecuador embassy. Confidential with embarrassing leaks about Ecuador President Moreno, and so on. So technically there was some procedure in the embassy as well. Arrested in prison 50 weeks for skipping UK bail. I don't remember the last thing that was happening with him. Do you remember? There was something recently. I can't recall. But the complexity, just imagine like the complexity of the international law, of the criminal law involved, you know, the different legislation across jurisdiction. So it can be very complex, and it will take, you know, years to investigate if there are no clear framework of agreement and cooperation. Let's take a short break until 13:10, just to refill the coffee, and then we start again. Right, welcome back. So we talked about the cooperation and how important it is to set, you know, these frameworks in place to establish, you know, framework to cooperate, to exchange the information. Because, for example, usually in Interpol there will be so-called seconded officers from, for example, from police in Norway. There are always one or two officers that were seconded to, for example, Singapore. The cooperation request, it's usually look like, for example, the recent investigation shows that the bank fraud botnet has been controlled by the IP address like that on June 1st, 2010. And please assist with the identification of the subscriber information if it's ISP, real-time collection of the traffic, data, recording, and all, you know, metadata that can be collected and identified. And also, you know, search and seize the computer equipment because it might have some relevant information and data on the computer. So the arenas for police cooperation, as I mentioned, Interpol, headquartered in Lyon and Singapore. So usually we have a few police officers from Norway seconded to those locations. Have no investigative or enforcement force, enforcement sorry, power, but it's more like a framework for cooperation and exchange and, you know, awareness and so on. The Europol Eurojust headquarters in The Hague facilitates European international cooperation, things like EC3, European Cybercrime Center, established 2013. In Norway, we have NC3, if you know, Kripos NC3. And it's devoted to investigating the cybercrime. So there is a quite long track list of the cooperation between NTNU and these organizations. Like, I've been part of the team that won the Interpol competition 2018 on the smart cities and the police. So we have also ongoing research projects. We have, provision technical advice to Interpol and so on. So there is a strong cooperation in that area. So if you're interested in, you know, any of the opportunities, just consider, you know, talking to the members of the staff at IAK, this is our department, and see what kind of opportunities, for example, for master project thesis or any other relevant projects exist. There is also a G8 subgroup on high-tech crime, 1997, to ensure that no safe haven for computer criminals and hackers. So it's the 24/7 cooperation, 40 member states, and now it's G7, so Russia is out. And like many of these cooperation agreements, they're bilateral, so it means that, you know, if one country participates together with another country, then they have it's kind of obligations to deliver, for example, information to support within given framework. They also have common systems, like, for example, in Europol, there is a EMAS, so European Malware Analysis System platform that is used by the police forces from different countries. So technically, they all have access to analyze and check the computer viruses, but only for the police forces. So like, I cannot access them. So if people are working in the police, they have credentials, then they have access. So the Norwegian law, there is a criminal law. So it kind of regulates the criminal offenses and what is considered to be criminal offenses. Criminal procedure law, investigation, prosecutions, and what is happening in the court of law. Copyright. So copyright and IP is very important. So there is, and so locally we have the copyright law. On European level, there is a EUIPO, so European Union Intellectual Property Office in Alicante, that handles all the copyright kind of related issues. Because it's not just, you know, copyright of image, but often we have, you know, distribution of the copyright infringing materials on the internet, like Justin Bieber songs, right, or something like this. And there is a data crime committee that governs investigation of data crimes, like anything that is related to data, computer data, and all the, you know, criminal activities. So the Norwegian law system, we have Justice Department, State Prosecutor, Courts, the Police Chief, Security, PSTE, so if you know PSTE, Security Police, National Criminal Police, Kripos, Kripos NCT Center, the ÖKOKRIM, so the Economic Crime Police, and the police districts. So in two lectures, we will have presentations from a police officer, investigator from Kripos. He's going to... Yes, please. I cannot answer this question because, you know, there might be some, let's say, connections that out of the scope in this course. But it's just a general framework that we use for, let's say, describing how the law enforcement work. For example, you know, NTNU has a good relationship and cooperation agreements with, for example, Kripos ÖKOKRIM. So we have common projects like Handscan. So this is from the Netherlands Forensics Institute. So we've been participating in developing the artificial intelligence models for this. There was a project called Ars Forensica. So it has finished recently, where the point was to consider like how the forensics and the criminal investigation can be facilitated by data analytics, for example, by using digital forensics tool testing and so on. But let's say this is, it's a little bit out of the scope in this course. We just give this information so that you can kind of understand and see like what are the particular departments are doing. So also before in the previous years, as a part of this course, we had presentation from, you know, from Kripos on mobile phone, like hacking. We had presentations on the like more procedural laws, kind of like how to apply the digital forensics and what are the investigative, for example, aspects. But unfortunately, they all are busy, and you know it's very difficult to fit them in our programs, in our guest lectures. Yes, and also as you know, we have Norwegian Cyber Range, so that also cooperates you know with different organizations, like for example, Cyber for Fire. So this is, you know, something that like it's one of the subjects actually here, but also in Jostermund we have a few colleagues working there as well. So they work there, but also they teach at NTNU, like for example Girulov. So Girulov will give a guest lecture in a few weeks time on the cyber operations. Yes. So the core competencies required for the digital investigation, it's we have kind of three-dimensional, three sides. This is a tactical, we have legal and technical. So the tactical is the correct methodologies for criminal investigation to obtain the digital evidence sources. technical correct methodology. So in this course, we talked a lot about kind of technical aspects. So this is, let's say, a scientific approach, a methodology used to identify, collect, examine all the evidences, and then represent. And the legal part, so the digital evidence requirements for successful prosecution. So that's kind of core competencies required for the digital investigations in general. There is also, for example, a need to give a testimony when a digital forensics expert gives a testimony. It includes all possible, you know, aspects of how the data carriers were identified, how the data were extracted from the data carriers, how the kind of necessary level of information was collected and later analyzed. And the important points, of course, the evidence integrity. So we spoke about the evidence dynamics, you know, things that are in the RAM, they can be changed extremely fast. Things that are on the tape backup recorders, they can stay, you know, for many years, and they kind of record it only once. There is no change to data. Order of volatility, so, you know, everything like how we collect and what kind of data and speed of changes of information is all related to order of volatility. And chain of custody. So if you remember from the previous time, I've talked a bit about the chain of custody and laboratory information management system, where, you know, autopsy can help you to put data in the report. So there are, of course, like challenges when it comes to documentation of aspects in the chain of custody, like, for example, collection, transportation, storage, examination, and analysis. So there is a huge, let's say, kind of, can say metaverse, but there are a lot of procedures and additional information that needs to be stored, collected, and processed so that, you know, it ensures that the evidence is collected on the crime scene, properly processed and analyzed up all the way up to the court hearings. And there are a lot of, you know, standard tools and methods that are used, like, for example, timestamps, cryptographic hash sums, logs, notes, reports, generated access logs, standard compliance. So it's everything also is in the, let's say, legal proceedings, because technically, all these terminologies, the standard computer terms, they need to be understood also by lawyers, for example. So there has to be an understanding what is a network packet. If it's ICT law, for example, related to ICT law, so they have a general understanding of what's this. But if you go more into details, then, you know, there has to be a testimony, there has to be some kind of explanation of what's kind of in the importance of that particular digital evidence. So double standard, I think I mentioned before, but also it will be mentioned later in this course. It's from US. You can read a little bit more about what is double standard. It's often used in the context of testing some model or software or a tool to be used to process data in the cases, or like doing, you know, the digital forensics. So the general idea is that you know, it establishes these rules or standards where we need to understand how the tool works. So we know for sure that, for example, the tool is deterministic all the time, independently from the platform it used on. When we put the data in, it will kind of like give the output that will be the same for different platforms. If the tool is run on Linux, on Windows, for example, and also in different period of time. It also has to be tested. It means that we need to know if there are any errors, like the tool cannot handle three keyword search. It just gives the blank result, while you know in reality there are some results. And then there has to be a certain, let's say, community acceptance of the program. So they have to be previous users that use this tool successfully, for example. And there has to be well documented. And also a set of standards used to support the tool. So that's basically a summary of a legal part, or let's say the chapter related to legal part of the digital forensics. You can read it about it a little bit more in details in the book. So please have a look at the Cybercrime Convention. So it's something that is very important, and you also will get a few questions, general questions about Cybercrime Convention later in the exam. Now, so that was the last slide. I'd like to mention the reference group. So we got two volunteers. Thank you very much for volunteering. It's the experience base. We have the local student, and also we're missing still a kind of a distant or remote students group. So if I don't get any volunteers, then we use the AI to select the volunteers. So if you have any comments regarding the learning outcomes, you can also talk to the members of the reference group that will be announced later. Yes, any questions? If you don't have any questions, thank you for attending today. I'm going to publish details of the next guest lecture in a few days, so that you know that on Tuesday we'll have a talk on AI for computer viruses analysis. And if you have any questions about, you know, project proposals, if you don't know where to go, please reach out. We can talk and we can find some interesting topic there.